Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and we have a terrific podcast for you today. J.B. Bickerstaff, the associate head coach of the Memphis Grizzlies, the former interim head coach of the Houston Rockets, takes us inside last season in Houston and talks about life on the road as the son of a former head coach. That's next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Welcome back. Another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Pleased to be joined here at the Las Vegas Summer League by J.B. Bickerstaff, the associate head coach now with the Memphis Grizzlies, was in Houston last year and quickly becoming one of the better young coaches, or being known as the better young coaches in the NBA. Today, JB, thanks for doing this, man.
No problem. Appreciate it.
I want to ask you because, you know, obviously your father, one of the better coaches for a long time in the NBA. I always like talking with some of the coaches that just get jobs and they have to relocate their families. And a lot of them say they don't relocate their families. They leave their families where they were. What was the dynamic like in the Bickerstaff household? Did you travel to wherever dad went or did you stick around?
Yeah, no, we traveled. I think that was, it was important to my mom. It was important to my dad that we were always together. Our family was the backbone of everything we did. You know, that was our strength, no matter what was happening. Because of the change, you know, there's always change, but we always knew we could count on each other. And I think it's important, you know, that if you move or wherever you go, that your family comes. My sister, she had it the worst. We were in Maryland at the time. My dad was coaching with the Bullets. Her senior year in high school, we went from Maryland, from Columbia, Maryland, to Redmond, Washington. When he started coaching with the Supersonics. So she was there for 1 year. You know, your senior year is a pretty big year for you, but we all traveled.
And you all, that's because you wanted it that way. You wanted to keep the family together.
Yeah, definitely. My mom and dad, you know, they preach to us over and over again the importance of family. You know, and I think in preaching that, you have to act on it. You know, and being together is the most important part of family.
Did you always know that you wanted to get into the family business?
Yeah, I always, you know, we always went to practice with my dad. You know, we were always around the guys. We were ball boys since we were like 5, 6 years old, my brother and I. And, you know, like there was no bigger role model to me than my dad growing up. You know, I was lucky. I never had to look outside of my house for someone I respected, someone who I wanted to be like. You know, he was great to us, you know, obviously as a dad. But as a kid, you know, you get to see him coaching, you know, all these stars and things like that. You know, like we went on a trip to the Bahamas for a Michael Thompson All-Star game, and my dad and Lenny Wilkins were the coaches, and it's, you know, Magic Johnson, Sweet Lou Dunbar, you know what I mean? Like there's all these people there, and he's there working with them, and they respect him. You know, they were appreciative of all the things that he did for them. So just as a kid growing up, you know, this is, you know, you were bright-eyed to it.
So you were like a different version of Steph Curry hanging around with dad in some ways.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was there. I mean, everywhere he went, you know, we would try to go. You know, it was hard, obviously, because he would travel so much. And, you know, back then the travel was different. It wasn't private flights. Everything was commercial. So he wasn't able to get back as soon, you know, as we can now. Like, at least now my kids wake up and I'm there. You know, I may have been gone the night before, but now when they wake up, I'm home. But back then, you know, you had to catch the first plane out, so we'd be at school and we'd be running home to get home from school just to see him.
I feel like that's the thing that people don't quite grasp, the commercial travel for teams. I remember, you know, great writers like from Boston area where I'm from, you know, Jackie McMullen and Bob Ryan talking about, you know, seeing Bird and McHale in the airport. Like these guys, you know, nowadays it would be insanity to think that you would find Mike Conley, Zach Randolph, and guys in your team in a commercial airport. But back then it was like that,
yeah,
right?
It was common. I mean, that's what they did. That was the only way. I think if I remember correctly, I think the Pistons may have been the first team to get their own plane. And that was, you know, everybody was in shock. But now, you know what I mean? Now it's commonplace. And, you know, you get so spoiled during the season. And then, you know, back in the summer, you're flying Southwest again.
Oh, man. And coach, and everyone gets spoiled on it. It's not just players, but, you know, coaches, staff members, when they don't get those meals on the plane, that pasta from the greatest place, or, you know, at Memphis from, you know, ribs from the whatever the best place down there, they notice.
Yeah. Oh, we're spoiled, Rob. We are. And exactly like you said, like, you know, all the way down to the snacks that we get on the plane, the chocolate-covered almonds, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, we're spoiled, right?
Being around practices like that, as you were, what was your some of your favorite memories of interactions between your dad, players, just things that stand out?
I think for me, you know, Seattle was a time when I was, you know, between the ages of 6 and 11, where I built a lot of really good relationships with people. You know, Dale Ellis was one of my favorite players and one of my favorite guys. Like, he would just take us, you know, to the mall, things like that. Sean Kemp, Dana Barros, Derek McKee, Nate McMillan, like all those guys, Xavier McDaniel, they were all like big brothers to us. And so whenever we'd be around, you know, we'd be playing one-on-one with those guys. You know, I don't know if this, I got, when I was probably like 7 or 8 years old, I was playing one-on-one with Xavier McDaniel. And, you know, at the time they weren't supposed to be playing with us because he was getting ready for the game. So he accidentally elbowed me and gave me a bloody nose. And so he was like, don't tell him. He said, make sure you just tell him that, you know, the ball hit you in the nose. And then he came back in the back and he gave me $50 and was like, here, shh, keep it quiet. I've never told that story before. He might get mad at me now.
No, $50, I think he's good with it right there. I spent 10 years as a ball boy with the Celtics. Mm-hmm. So I have like this booklet of all the guys I played one-on-one with as a 12 to, like it was 22, whatever it was, 13 to 23-year-old. And it's like me, skinny, geeky kid with glasses, you know, playing Ray Allen and Tracy McGrady in his early years. You must have had those. Yeah. It was always fun because, you know, it's when guys would be willing to, you know, you want to defend them when they're warming up. They never really shied away from that often.
No, they were, and that's the thing about it. It's like, you know, people don't see enough of that, you know, and aren't a part of those interactions. The way guys, and it's still the same this way today, that the way that guys treat kids and the people that are a part of the organization, I mean, they're great, you know, to kids and the interactions that they have with them, and they understand the impact that interaction can have. You know what I mean? Like, those small moments are life-changing moments for, you know, kids or, you know, whatever, whoever the people are that they're working with. And I think that's one thing that, you know, nobody focuses on that. They don't put enough attention on those small things and how much of a difference that makes in people's
lives. You got in Seattle, Dana Barros in his prime, that probably his best year, his all-star year, I think was in Seattle. Dana doesn't get a lot of the credit that others got, but they don't come much better than Dana Barros shooting the basketball.
No, I mean, he was unreal. You know, him and Sean Kemp were rookies together. You know, Sean, you know, obviously, you know, went on to be a multiple-time all-star, but Dana had, you know, huge games and huge runs and was very, you know, important in what they did. And he could stroke it. You know, he could stroke it from deep. Even one time, they let him jump center one game, and they won the tip. So for like 3 games in a row, he was jumping center, and then finally he ended up losing the tip, so they stopped letting him jump center.
Oh, man. He had the record for a long time. Was it consecutive games with a three-pointer? And I distinctly remember, because he was in Boston when he lost that record, and he was so mad because Don Nelson, who I think was coaching the Knicks at that time, was, you know, he knew Dana had the record, and at the end of the game, he tripled. It was like the game was decided, and he triple-teamed Dana. I don't think Dana's ever forgotten that.
No,
like,
I bet he would.
If you stop him one-on-one, okay, but don't. Like, that bothered Dana when Nelly, you know, sent 3 guys at him for that.
Yeah, I don't think that's right.
That's just wrong.
Yeah, that's not right.
I mean, Sean Kemp in those days was something else to watch, wasn't he?
The Rain Man. It was like he literally had his own bottled water. He had his own comic books. I mean, in Seattle, he was huge. There was no bigger star than Sean. And he was, like, just the way he played, you know, the game, the way he, you know, the dunks that he had. You know, they're just, like, even in today's game where, you know, it looks like the guys are getting freakier and freakier, like, he's one of the guys who could have survived and would have been on par with these guys.
Yeah, it's too bad that there's a generation that still sees or only sees Sean as the guy after the lockout that got bigger and wasn't the Rain Man anymore. Because you're right, he was fantastic.
He was a stud. He was 19 when he first came in. Mm-hmm. You know his background story of being at Kentucky, then leaving to go to junior college and coming to the NBA. And then being able to turn it around and, you know, make it into a positive. And he was one of the guys who, even as I got older, you know, I would see and stay in touch with and talk with. And he's just a good dude, you know.
Were you around there when Peyton got there?
The year that they drafted Gary was the year we left to go to Denver. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get a chance to see him play there. But he and I actually, because when I went to Oregon State, he was one of the guys that I talked to about going there. Mm-hmm. And so he was one of the reasons why I went there, because of the way he played. You know, he told me that it was a place, you know, it was a good place to be and all those things. I actually just saw him in Corvallis. We were playing in Portland. We drove down to Corvallis. They were playing University of Washington. He was at the game, and we talked for a while. So he's doing good, and he was, I mean, you know, obviously we know the glove.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think they came that defensively. I mean, I wonder how Gary Payton would do today in today's rules, because he was physical.
Yeah.
Man. He played you. Anything you were allowed to do, Gary Payton did back in those days.
Yeah, he'd be more frustrated. He'd be more frustrated than anything right now. But, I mean, just, yeah, you know, and that's the thing, too, is, you know, he had his reputation, you know, and it's like a lot of guys now. You know, you have your reputation and you get away with a little bit, you know, more. You can be a little more physical. You can be a little more handsy. So he would have been able to adjust, but he'd been a nightmare for people.
Do you tell guys as a coach, you know, kind of a little off topic here, but when, you know, I've always heard some coaches say that, you know, especially for rookies, if you play physical, you know, keep playing physical and make the referees kind of adjust to you. I don't know if I'm saying that quite accurately, but, you know, I guess some people have told me in the past that, you know, if referees see you bodying a guy all the time, they're not going to call it every single time. Is that something
yeah,
you...
I mean, you know, obviously, having to be careful around this subject, you know, you play within the rules, you know, but there are, you know, basketball is a contact sport. So you want to play that way all the time. You know, I think if you don't play that way all the time and then you do it, that's when it stands out to people and that, you know, is a quicker trigger for the referees. But if you're physical all the time, if you're, you know, beating guys to spots, putting your body on them, like things that you're allowed to do within the rules, then the referees let you, you know, they let you play that way.
Who was really good at that, at being physical all the time to the point where, you know, referees just let certain things go?
Tony Allen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, even, I mean, now, like, Tony Allen is one of the best that you see at, like, blowing up screens and getting through screens. And there's a point of intersection where, you know, those guys' bodies are going to meet, mm-hmm. you know, and he just, you know, for so many years, he's been so good at it and so consistent, you know, that he's able to do it and he gets away with it.
Did you, going back to how you got into this business, did you think growing up was getting into the family business always something you had your eye on? I mean, I'm guessing that, you know, everyone wants to follow the dream of being a player first. Mm-hmm. You know, some dreams die earlier than others. Mine died in high school, sadly. 6'2" shooting guards weren't really big in the in the circuit. But did you, was coaching always something for you?
Yeah, I wanted to play as long as I possibly could and just see what happened. Obviously, you know, we all dreamed of playing in the NBA growing up. You know, I was lucky enough to play college at University of Minnesota. You know, I broke my leg my junior and senior year there. And then from there, it was kind of like, you know, I knew I always wanted to be a coach. So, you know, what was the best route? You know, was it going to be a college coach? Was it going to be an NBA? Would it be a video coordinator? Those types of things. I even went down to the Final Four, you know, that whole thing they tell you do to pass out your resume. And, you know, I was going to try looking for a graduate assistant job or something like that. But I was lucky that Coach Munson, Dan Munson, a job opened up, and he gave me an opportunity there for a year. I was working with him, and then the next year I did radio for the Timberwolves, mm-hmm. The year they went to the Western Conference Finals with Sam Cassell and KG and Sprewell. And then the following years, my dad got the job in Charlotte, and he took me with him there. So, you know, you never know you always hope to have a plan. But in this business, you never know the direction that it's going to take you because there's so much random and there's so much, you know, so much luck that plays a part of it.
How were your interactions with KG as a radio broadcaster?
He was very good to me. Yeah, like I knew after the games and things like that. Like I wouldn't ask the question. I just put my little, you know, recorder in the huddle and let all the other people
ask the question. You let somebody else ask the question for
me,
didn't you?
You're 100% right. That's right. I just put like recorder in there and I let somebody else answer questions. But he was unbelievable to me as a person. He took care of me. You know, he'd take me out to dinner. You know, that group was a great group of guys to be around.
It's the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
And now a word from Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. Fast, powerful, and completely online, Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts out of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork? With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all this on your phone or tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/Mannix. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030. And now, back to J.B. Bickerstaff. When you and you can correct me if I'm saying this inaccurately, but when your father gets the job and he offers you the job down there, do you worry at all about, you know, the perception of, all right, my dad got the job, he's handing me an assistant coaching job? What was your thought process there?
Well, you know, out of respect for him, I knew I had to be really good. You know, you can't get that job in that position, obviously being the head coach's son, and then, you know, come in and be a guy who's lazy, come in a guy who's not prepared, you know, come in and be, you know, a distraction, you know, what have you. You have to be on your toes. You have to be really good at what you're doing. So my whole focus was I have to do, one, I wanted to impress my father, you know, two, I wanted to please him, and then, you know, I wanted his reputation to stay the way it was and not, you know, think he's got some, you know, some wild kid or something, you know, I mean, who's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, or, you know, is he good at his job, or he's just, you know, along for the ride. So I put all my effort into being, you know, as good a coach as I possibly could be.
What was that first year like, working for your father, trying to earn that respect? I mean, what was that like for you?
It was awesome. You know, like, our relationship, still to this day, we talk every day. But at that point in time, it was the first time that we had really been together, you know, in a long, long time. You know, I was 24 years old, so I was pretty fresh out of college. He had always been, you know, on the move and on the go, and coaching and stuff like that. But this was like the first time in my life that we were basically together every day. Mm-hmm. So it was awesome experience for me. You know, I got to learn a lot. You know, I got put in my place when I needed to be put in my place. But he gave me freedom to work. And again, you know, he just said, be prepared. That was the most important thing, is whatever we do, we have a plan and you move forward with that plan. But, you know, like being able to wake up on Sunday morning and going over to mom and dad's house and having breakfast. You know what I mean? Like, those are things that, you know, I didn't have much of a chance to do in a childhood. So for me, it was a great experience.
Did you notice, or did your father, did he tell you after the fact, did he go out of his way at all to come down on you, you know, if you did slip up on something, to show that it wasn't just going to be my son, you know, I'm not going to hit him? Speaking figuratively, of course, I'm not gonna hit him like I'd hit another assistant coach with criticism.
Yeah, he was the same. You know what I mean? That's the thing about him. My dad is a really fair person. You know, he understands there will be mistakes made. You know what I mean? He'll correct your mistakes. You know, his thing is, you don't make the same mistakes. And from that perspective, we never had, you know, much of an issue. But when it was time to come down on me, he came down on me like a father would come down on his son, not like a father or a, you know, head coach would come down on an assistant coach. But again, that was our relationship. So, you know, it never bothered me. With him, you know, the most important thing that I learned from him is it's never personal. If it's personal, you got a real problem, you know what I mean? And you need to move on from that situation. But I knew he was just trying to make me better. So it was never, you know, I never took it anyway. I never got in my feelings. I took it, I listened, I learned. You know, and he doesn't hold a grudge, you know, so it was over with. As soon as it was out of his mouth, you know, it was corrected and it was over with, and we moved forward.
Your father's a basketball lifer, isn't he? I see him at Wizards games. Like, yeah. He's sitting on the press row doing some scouting there, and I've talked to him just, you know, talking basketball, sitting next to him, man. He still's got that fire.
Yeah, no, he loves it. I laugh at him because he has no hobbies. So, like, he doesn't play golf. You know, he likes to fish a little bit, but he won't get on a boat because he doesn't like to swim. You know, the only thing he does is he watches old Westerns, and he loves black and white movies. The Turner Classic Channel, he's sitting in the house all day long and watch the Turner Classic Channel.
He likes to fish, but he doesn't like to go on a boat. Right. That must make it, I guess, dock fishing.
And again, in D.C., he's not getting out going fishing. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't do a whole lot.
When you branched out, you know, away from your father, was it important to you to take a job, go to another job that wasn't, after a certain point, that wasn't working for your father?
Yeah, it was important. Again, in our business, you know, I mean, you have to develop some sort of a reputation. And, you know, being in one place, in one system, one style, under one head coach, you know, I think you're in that box. You know, once you start to branch out and spread yourself out, the tree grows. You know, the people you know that you've worked for are changing. They're different. You know, they move on and know somebody else. You know what I mean? So it expands your tree. And I think in our business, that's the most important thing, is having that tree. Obviously, you know, the Spurs tree is unreal, but that's what you're trying to build. And by moving around and working for other people, you're trying to gain that respect from them. And hopefully that word travels, you know, and then, you know, you can keep a job. I mean, that's the most important thing for us is, you know, all you can control is the effort you put into your job, you know, how well you do your job, how prepared you are. Some circumstances just aren't built for winning. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been through those situations. So you're going to pay the consequences. You know, we understand that coming into this business as coaches, but what type of job did you do in those circumstances? Did you do a good enough job where someone will say, hey, you know, I'm going to give him a chance somewhere else? And that's what we try to do every day.
What did you take as a coach from that was different than you had before from someone like Kevin McHale, who you know, a former player, one of the greats of all time, and had become an established head coach as well? What did he add to what you know, consider your philosophies?
Well, there's a ton of knowledge, first and foremost, that he added. You know, the conversations that we would have alone about, you know, his career and back in his playing, you know, time. You know, I mean, there's so much to be learned about that. There's, you know, the game is different, but fundamentally it's still the same. And he would tell us stories about, you know, the way they did things, how, you know, their practices were, how their pick and roll coverages were. You know, those types of things are things you take and you learn. What I think he does best is he puts players in a situation to be as successful as they can possibly be. And that's all he wants from you. You know, he's not asking you to be somebody you're not. You know, he's giving you freedom to go out and do what you need to do. But with that freedom comes responsibilities to the team. You know, there's no selfishness, those types of things. So I learned, you know, watching him handle players and how to get the most out of guys and, you know, putting guys in position to succeed and making guys feel, you know, that, you know, if your job is to rebound, then you're the best rebounder on the planet, you know, so go out and do that job and be proud of that job is something that I took from him.
I can only imagine. I mean, he must have some great stories.
Yes.
The 1980s must have been insane, you know, with how good that team was and the personalities in that locker room. Anything you could share that stands out of his story?
The stories of, you know, how much they really won. You know, like when I was younger and I was, you know, you're watching it, you don't really, you know, take that into, you know, consideration. You don't think about it as much, but they won a ton of games. And he talked about in his career, he played with, I think it's 12 Hall of Famers. You know, like you think about that, that's unbelievable to, you know, be on one team in one organization and play with 12 Hall of Famers.
Several of them at the same time for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, those guys, that team. I mean, one of the things about those teams, and this sort of, you know, connects to nowadays. Nowadays, it seems like the public expects teammates to be in love with each other every second of every day. They think if there's body language issues or something else, then, oh, it can't work. That dynamic's totally dysfunctional. I remember those. Just reading body language on some of those 80s Celtics teams, I would imagine McHale, Bird, Parrish, they didn't always get along back in those days.
Yeah, no, they got into it. You know, he would tell us the stories about, you know, missed assignments, missed coverages, you know. But for them, the only thing that mattered was winning. Mm. And that was the biggest thing. You know, the money was good, but it wasn't, you know, what it is now, obviously. And it wasn't as much of the branding that goes on now. So the only thing that was important, you know, was winning. So, yeah, you may be pissed at a guy, but you're still going to go out and do what you need to do to try to help the team win. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to be so upset that, and, you know, from a selfish standpoint, that you're just worrying about yourself. You're going to pout. You're going to be upset. You're not going to help the team. It was, okay, you're pissed off, but I still got to figure out a way to help us win. And, you know, those are the stories that he tells, you know, time and time again of, you know, guys being down or guys, you know, feeling like they got looked off, you know, and then the next quarter or whatever, it became their quarter, you know, and they were able to help the team win. And that was the kind of camaraderie that he talked about. And you know, that's what you want out of your teams, you know, now.
How did he describe his relationship with Bird all throughout those years?
I mean, he loves him. I mean, I've heard more Birdie stories than you could possibly imagine. But, you know, he's got a ton of respect for him. And he always speaks highly of him. And he's, you know, he speaks of him almost with like an admiration. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I think he looks up to and looked up to Larry, you know, the type of player that he was. And I think Larry pushed him to make him a better player.
Every coach in an assistant position wants to be a head coach. That's what you do the job for. I mean, what was your feeling on the day that you ascended to the job in Houston, but at the same time, it was also a day that Kevin lost his job?
Yeah, I mean, it was a terrible day. It was awful, I'll be honest with you. We didn't see it coming, you know, didn't think it was necessary. We understood where we were. We understood what we were dealing with and how we would, you know, set the course to right the ship. And just from a personal standpoint, Kevin's done so much for me and my family that it was, you know, I went back and forth on, you know, is it okay to do this? You know what I mean? Like, is this the right thing to do? And, you know, because I thought he was done wrong. You know, I thought it was unfair for him to take the heat in this situation. I didn't think it was deserving. So it was difficult for me. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you're given an opportunity. Now you have to do something, right? I had a responsibility to the 15 guys on the roster, the other guy, you know, other guys on the coaching staff, that we had to try to do the best job we could do for one another to put that team in a position to be as successful as we possibly could. So, you know, all the lessons that you learn from Kevin as a great player and a great teammate, as a great coach, you know, my dad as a great coach, you know, the guys that I've been around, you know, the Randy Whitmans, the Kurt Rambises, those stories that I hear from them is, you know, it's all about being unselfish and sacrificing yourself. So my focus going in was, how can I be the best teammate that I can possibly be for the players, for the coaches, for the front office, for the organization? So whatever feelings I had, I put them on the back burner and just tried to give myself to everybody else and do what I thought was right to help that team stabilize itself and then put itself in the best position.
When you have those feelings, the conflicted feelings, what ultimately pushes you in the direction of saying yes to the job? What were some of the influences there?
It's the opportunity, you know, and be honest with you, there's only 30 NBA jobs.
Of course.
You know, and it's not like you can go, you know, to Europe or, you know, I mean, like this is it, and there's 30 of them. And, you know, as a child, this was your dream, is to be a head coach. You know, Kevin and I talked, we still speak. He understood, you know, what the situation was. He was supportive all year long. You know, he texted me during, you know, bad stretches. He texted me during good stretches. You know, he was always there for me. Any questions I ever had, he was there for me. So he made it a lot easier as well. You know, if it would have been a situation where, you know, he and I would have had some friction over it, I think it would have bothered me even more. But the fact that he was so supportive and the fact that he was always behind me and helping me, I think it made it a lot easier.
Before he got let go, had you identified what was kind of going on there? Because you were a conference finalist the year before in Houston. Were you able to put your finger on exactly what you guys weren't doing at that point?
Yeah, I think it came down to, you know, when we go back and we looked at it, we didn't have a very good preseason. You know, we had guys injured during training camp, guys injured during the preseason, and we weren't able to get the things done that we needed to get done to prepare ourselves to be the caliber of team that we wanted to be. So from that point, we were constantly playing catch up, you know, and that's what made it so difficult. We were down, you know, obviously, I think we were like 10th in the Western Conference at the time, but we were always trying to chase everybody down. And after a while, that wears you out. But, you know, there was a part in time in the year where I thought, you know, we had done a pretty good job of, you know, getting stable. And then, you know, there were some bumps in the road that just seemed like we could just never get over the hump, get over the hill to see the horizon enough. You know, it was always something was just always coming, and it would always, you know, knock us back a little bit. But, you know, again, you know, we had to close out the season by winning. It was 3 straight games or whatever. We did that to make it into the playoffs. And then, you know, obviously we ran into a very good team in the playoffs. But, you know, I think, you know, to stabilize that team and get it into the playoffs, I think everybody that was a part of it did a good job.
It's hard enough with a full training camp and preseason to implement or, you know, put your stamp on a team. It must be even more difficult to do it on the fly. I mean, how much of your coaching philosophy did you try to put, you know, install with this team versus just kind of minor tweaks because of the lack of a practice time and, yeah, and ability, I mean, to change things?
Yeah, and you know, we played a certain style of basketball, you know what I mean? So systematically, it's hard to come in and change that. without a training camp, without time to really practice. I mean, you know how it is during a regular season. There's not a ton of practice days for you.
Especially with an older team.
Yeah, exactly. We had a bunch of vets on the team, so we weren't going to try to beat those guys down. So it was difficult. We made small changes, you know, minor tweaks defensively and offensively, but, you know, still tried to do the things that we were really good at more, you know, and that's where our focus was. You know, from a philosophy standpoint, as far as like how I wanted the players to be treated, how I was going to treat them, how I was going to treat, you know, my staff, how our staff was going to treat each other, I think that's where our, you know, sacrificing and giving to your team, giving to your staff, giving to one another, like those are things that I really believe in. Those are things that I tried to impress upon the team, and you know, that's what we were going to do regardless of the results. You know, the guys that, you know, our staff and things, like, we were going to give, and we were going to try to get the most out of that group.
Did you feel like as you're trying to right the ship, you know, with the personalities in that locker room, did you feel like there were chemistry issues that were tough to overcome?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that. You know, I think, again, guys wanted the same result, right? Guys wanted to win, I think, first and foremost. You know, how we were going to get to that, I think, is where we had the biggest problem. You know, I think that's where that was a bigger issue for us than, you know, I guess, you know, we throw around the word chemistry.
But yeah, it's a broad stroke word.
We were trying to all get to the same place. You know, but in a group with characters as strong as we had, you know, proven guys, you know, sometimes, you know, we all weren't on the same page of how we were going to get to that spot.
Was it frustrating as a coach to not be able to meld that together, to get them all kind of on that same page, knowing, I mean, it's not a sort of a figurative wonder, oh, how good can we be? You knew how good you could be. You could be a conference finalist if everybody, you know, kind of was. Was it frustrating as a coach to not find a way to get these guys onto that page?
Yeah, it was tough because, you know, you would get them. We would be on, you know, in the right place at times. You know, the hard part for us was staying there. And that's what it became, you know, that's what was frustrating. Like, we knew what we were capable of. We knew that we could do certain things and we could play at a certain level. We could play a certain way, you know, and we would do it for, you know, spurts. And then for whatever reason, you know, those issues would arise and then, you know, we'd have a drop off. We'd have a bump in the road. You know, it was a difficult situation. It was definitely frustrating at times.
I remember your last press conference after the getting beat in the playoffs, and it seemed like you were maybe even more frustrated at that moment than you had been prior to that. I mean, look, you play Golden State. That's they're a pretty damn good team. But did you, even with the 8th seed and the struggles you had this year, did you have higher expectations for your team in that series?
Yeah, you know, I think, again, we could have put ourselves in a better situation. You know, we played them in game 4, I believe it was, and maybe it was game 3, where, you know, it's a tie game at halftime, Steph gets hurt.
Yep. You know,
there's an opportunity now for us at home to come out and play better and try to, you know, and win that game. And I don't think we took full advantage of that. You know, they went on a run. Draymond Green came out. And again, you know, they're champions and they're not a one-man show. You know, so those other guys stepped up in that moment. But I just thought there was a moment there to be seized. And I just didn't think that we took the time. You know, we didn't seize that moment. As big of the stage as it was, we didn't seize the opportunity.
You said it. There are only 30 of these jobs in the NBA. When the season ended, you ultimately took yourself out of consideration for the head job, but did you want that job after the season was over?
You know, to be honest with you, with all the things that happened last year, I don't think I was the right person for that job. I think they needed to come in with something and someone fresh and kind of restart what they were trying to do. So they were great to me. The ownership was great. Leslie was great. Daryl was great. Tad Brown. You know, all those guys were unbelievable to me. They gave me everything that I needed during the year. You know, any support that I needed, they did it. They were there, you know, and they included me in conversations. They made me feel like a piece of it. It wasn't just like, here, you know, you're on your own. they were wonderful to me. But it just, you know, it just was something that I thought that was, you know, I wasn't the right guy for that job.
Well, what made you think that? Because, I mean, you if you had the job, you could probably have a full training camp. I would imagine there'd be things that you'd want to do with your own philosophy. Was there something you saw along the way that made you, was it the fact that you think your voice wasn't being heard enough? Was there something that you saw?
I just think that, you know, from where they were, where we were at the beginning of the year with our expectations to where we finished. And again, you know, the things that we went through on through that year, you know, I just thought that that place, it needed a fresh voice. It needed a fresh face. You know, there was things that happened through the year that, you know, tested relationships, those types of things, to where it just felt like it was the right thing to do.
When you ultimately take yourself out of consideration for the job, I mean, what are you feeling at that point? This is your first opportunity, and look, that's not on you. Like the way that, I mean, there was, as you said, there were a lot of things that went on in that locker room with that team that led to where they ended up. But when you finish that first chance at a coaching job, and it doesn't end the way you had hoped it would end, I mean, how are you feeling confidence wise? How are you feeling about the job you did in Houston?
I mean, I thought I did a good job. I, you know, showed up every day and went to work. Accepted all challenges that came my way. You know, so I wasn't doubting myself. You know, again, there's no guarantee that I was going to get that job. And I, you know, to be honest with you, I probably wasn't going to get that job. You know, I think I understood that as well. And, you know, for me, it was more about moving on to whatever was going to be next. And, you know, they went through a process where they were going to interview a lot of people. They were very thorough in the job that they did of interviewing people. So, you know, for me, looking at it as the chances were slim that I would get that job, you know, just you're looking for what's next. And I was fortunate enough that, you know, I know enough people and have enough, good enough relationships with people that I thought I would get an opportunity just as a matter of where and which one was going to be the right one.
It seemed like you were focused on getting an assistant job after it was over. There were a bunch of head coaching vacancies there. And again, there's no guarantee you would have gotten any of them, but it did seem like, from what I was hearing, that you wanted to take an assisting job. Is that accurate? Were you looking at head jobs?
I mean, you don't get to look. That's the thing about it. You know,
it's
they ask you. Yeah. So you got to be asked. And you know, I wasn't asked. So, you know, I got an opportunity to talk to the people in Orlando, but they obviously went, you know, in another direction. But I thought, you know, our conversations went really well. I got a lot of respect for those guys, and I think they have, you know, a match respect for me as well. But, you know, you go for the, you know, you take your shot when you're open. You know, if you don't have a shot, you move on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some jobs came available. Again, you know, good friends got good jobs, and I was, you know, fortunate enough to, you know, have some options at the end of the day, and then, you know, need to pick what was right for myself and my family.
Yeah, and the upshot, of course, is that you did have those options, and you were able to pick, you know, from very good assistant coaching opportunities. What was it about Memphis that made you think that was the right place?
First is my relationship with Coach Fizdale. I've known him since I was 17 years old, and we've got a great relationship. You know, he was in my wedding, you know. There's no one I trust more in this business than him.
I'm starting to get the sense that you know, like, everybody.
I know a lot of people. I'll be honest with you. I know a lot of people. So that was the biggest part of it. You know, he and I had talked about it beforehand. It was, you know, whoever got the job first, you know, the other one was coming with them. So this wasn't something that just kind of, you know, came out. And then, you know, there's no one more that I'm, you know, want to push for, want to fight for, want to support than him. So, you know, it was an easy situation. Obviously, I think the organization is good. I think they've got talented players who are about the right things. You know, we just obviously need to get healthy. But, you know, you got a guy like Mike Conley and Marc Gasol, Zach Randolph, Tony Allen, guys that have, you know, proven, you know, and are in a win now type mode, you know, not a rebuild. So I just thought it'd be a great fit. And again, you know, it was easy for me. Being able to work with Fizz.
Do your coaching philosophies, are they, how close to in sync are they? Do they need to be, I guess, as you an assistant?
Yeah, but I think, you know, I think your coaching philosophy follows a lot of how you are as a person. And people you're friends with, you know, you normally have like minds. You know, obviously we don't agree on everything. You know, he comes from that Heat culture where they, you know, is different than when I was in Houston, you know, with the way, you know, we did things. So there's not always going to be, we're not on the same page, and he didn't hire me to be, you know, his yes man, to be mm-hmm. on the same page. He hired me to help him and to push him and challenge him and, you know, force thought, you know what I mean? So we'll have discussions about what we believe in, you know, things we need to do differently. Why not do this? Why should we do this? Why do you believe in this? We've already had those conversations. But again, because we've known each other for so long and so well, it's never personal. You know, it's about what's best for the team, you know, what's best for our staff. So we just run those things off each other. We can argue, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter. And then it's over with and we move forward.
Memphis is and has been a very good team for most of the last 7-8 years with Mark and Zach, and obviously the rise of Mike as a point guard. Adding Chandler Parsons makes it an even better team. But how do you deal with the Goliath kind of in the conference? I mean, do you put it out of your mind in some ways that that team is just so damn good with multiple MVPs and the stars that they have? I mean, do you address that with the team at all, or how do you handle it?
It's a culture, and that's the thing that coaches talked about the most is, you know, you have a championship culture, and that's the only thing that matters. You know, you approach it like you're trying to win a championship. So you don't think about them. I don't care what, you know, we don't care what Golden State's doing. We don't care what, you know, San Antonio's doing. We don't care what. What are we doing in Memphis that's going to help put us in position to win a championship? That's the only thing that matters. And that's one of the things that Fizz has done such an unbelievable job of bringing that in, you know, and making, you know, those small changes, making big changes, and the, you know, to put that championship culture in place. And he's got a clear vision of it. You know, he teaches us that vision and we preach his vision. And, you know, I think he's going to do, you know, a hell of a job there. I think he's already on the right path. Creating that, and then obviously once all the guys show up, you know, then it starts, and you know, they're already, you know, they walk into something instead of having to get there and figure it out.
One of the things I like about today's NBA is that more and more assistant coaches are getting opportunities. I don't think that was the case, you know, for most of the last 8 to 10 years. You had either college coaches or, you know, recycled as a negative word, I don't want to use that, but coaches that have been in other spots, veteran coaches that have been there, as opposed to the assistants. Nowadays, you've got Fizdale, Kenny Atkinson, there's a whole list of guys that have gotten head coaching jobs. Do you think at your next opportunity, whenever that may be, how much different will you be as a coach? What do you take away from that Houston experience that will make you a better coach down the line?
Just the experience, you know. The experience of leading a team to a playoffs is a huge experience in our field. Prepping for playoffs, you know, coaching a team every day for, you know, 100 days or 120 days, whatever, you know, however long the season is, it's like that is where you learn. You know, it's what decision do you make with 2 minutes to go? You know, what guy do you put in this position? How do you deal with, you know, this guy, you know, having a bad night, but he's your, you know, best player, or, you know, all those things. Now, I've made those decisions before. So, and when you are an assistant coach, you know, I always say you get to make suggestions. You know, as a head coach, you make decisions. So having made those decisions, you know, you're better for it and you're more confident doing it the next time.
You're going to become like a barbecue guy now and, you know.
Probably will eat a lot of barbecue. Someone told me don't eat a lot of barbecue because you're going to get fat. So I'm a little nervous about getting fat. So
your family's going to talk with Southern accents now.
That's right. My kids. I'm worried about my kids.
How old are they?
5, 4, and my son will be 3 in August.
I would imagine the 3-year-old.
Yeah.
If you're there for a few years,
yeah,
it's going to be y'all's.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Houston is a little country.
That's true, too.
Yeah.
So now you get, you're ramping it up a little
exactly.
bit, amplifying
I'm going to another level of country, and yeah, so I'm afraid for my kids.
Well, JB, congratulations on the new gig. You definitely deserve it, and best of luck next season.
No problem. Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Memphis Grizzlies associate head coach JB Bickerstaff. Don't forget, you can download this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, really anywhere you can download podcasts. And when you go to iTunes, make sure you give us a rating, leave us a comment. We'll try to answer them as fast as we possibly can. And don't forget, you can download the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Woj there too. See you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.